Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 24, Cannon Fodder.
The purpose of Shortbox Showcase is to talk about topics and comics that fall outside of our respective solo shows.
But first, a little feedback.
That is completely inaccurate.
But first, a lot of feedback.
Much better.
Our last two episodes have generated way more feedback than any episodes we've ever done. You guys seem to have a lot to say about underread comics and superhero novels.
That was kind of a serendipitous event to have two episodes that we sort of knew would have a lot of listener responses back to back.
I wish we had planned that out.
Yes.
Well, maybe next time.
But we are not professionals in any way, shape, or form. So, starting with episode 22, the underread comics. Paul in Greensboro said that Baker Street number 1 is available on drivethroughcomics.com, and hopefully more will be added soon. He bought his copy the other day but hadn't yet read it, so wanted to shout out to us for recommending it.
And like the Quarterbin podcast, we only recommend books up to and including a price point of 25 cents. Beyond that, you're on your own. 3 for a dollar, 50 cents, 99 cents. We cannot guarantee the quality of any comic above 25 cents.
Yes, but most of them are legit good and cheap. This is why we combine our powers.
We also got a message from Michael Bradley on that topic. Michael, of course, from the Superman and Batman podcast and Parallel Lines, the
Tangent Universe podcast.
I was about to say that.
Sure, you were.
I was going to say Green Lantern, but that's the other guy, Sean.
Check out all three of those shows. They are all excellent.
Has Sean ever written another show? Anyway, Michael Bradley says, Professor Allen and Emily, I enjoyed episode 22, your look at favorite underread or undervalued series. I've never read any of the series discussed, with one sort of exception, which I'll get to, but enjoyed hearing you talk about them. Since you asked, I thought I'd offer a suggestion of my own. It's a series from DC Comics, Hero, H-E-R-O. That series, which ran for 22 issues starting in 2003, was written by Will Pfeiffer and illustrated by several different artists. A new one came on board for every arc. The series is an updated version of DC's Dial H for Hero concept. Hey, where are you going? Come back! There's more to the email! It's Dial H for Hero, not Dial H for Hater! Come back, please!
Oh.
At least Michael understands the appropriate reaction to someone recommending Dial H for Hero.
I'm intrigued by Dial H for Hero. I just haven't read any of it yet, because I've heard a lot of it kind of sucks.
Well, as Michael was saying, in the concept of the series, there's no central character other than the dial itself, and we find the dial landing in the hands of different person with each arc. In the first arc, it's a down-on-his-luck 20-something, and the next a white-collar office slave, then a young girl, then a low-level criminal, etc. The stories explore how each person uses the dial and the ramifications it has on their lives. Unfortunately, the series only ran 22 issues. There was a lot of untapped potential in the series. There could be a wide range of tones and settings and characters. The first 6 were reprinted in a trade, but the other 16, as of this writing, remain uncollected. That's it for now. Still enjoying the show. Michael Bradley. All right, thanks, Michael. Moving on to the next one.
P.S.?
Hmm?
Sorry that Emily didn't enjoy Grant Morrison's series reinventing The Shining Knight as much as she enjoyed Demon Knights. In my experience, Morrison's Seven Soldiers epic is a bit of an acquired taste. While each of the miniseries were written to stand on their own, and they do to an extent, a read of the full event really is needed to, I think, see what Morrison was trying to do. I think it's also one of those series that grows with each reading. I've read it through twice and enjoyed it more the second time. If I read it a third, I'll probably enjoy it even more. Plus, Morrison's style isn't a taste everyone enjoys. It's hit and miss with me. And this is Morrison as most Morrisoniest. Not saying you should read the entire saga, only that I understand why you didn't necessarily enjoy what you did read.
P.P.S. Wow, that was a long P.S.
Thank you for writing in, Michael.
Now, I did want to talk just about the timing of that episode. I think we may have mentioned it, maybe last episode, that underread, underappreciated comics episode was recorded many months before it aired.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the reason why we didn't mention the Hey Kids comics, epic 3-episode discussion of every issue of Seven Soldiers, is because it was released between the time we recorded and the time that it was released.
That was a huge temporal oversight that we had no real control over. So I wanted to give them a shout out now. It's epic. I have only listened to a little bit of it because it's something like 6.5 hours long.
And it's about Grant Morrison.
Which, like Michael, not really a huge fan. Like, I enjoy what he does, but Morrison
can be Morrisoniest.
Yes. Morrison at his Morrisonianist is a little bit too Morrisony-y for me.
Spoilers. Andy came away from Seven Soldiers at least appreciating it, if not outright liking it.
That's the thing. I get that if I were to read all 47 or 49 issues or whatever, I would probably like more than half of them and appreciate all of them. But that's just, it's a lot of Morrison. Much like that epic 3-part podcast extravaganza, I will be chipping away at it probably for the next 2 to 4 years.
I understand.
From Ben Avery, fun episode. Sword of the Atom belongs to a trinity of heroes in high fantasy series that I love. Doom Quest, Legacy of Doom is one.
Hail Doom.
Of course. Sword of the Atom is the second, and Incredible Hulk, Heart of the Atom. All three are collected, and if you've read and or liked any one of them, you should probably enjoy the others. A rampaging smart Hulk smashing his way across a fantastical world and falling in love? What's not to like? That does sound pretty epic.
He raises an interesting point.
Yeah. That is all of the things I love. Smash, high fantasy, romance, dragons. Maybe there are dragons. I hope there are dragons. If there aren't dragons, there should be.
Ben, email us back in and tell us if there are dragons.
Yes!
Manuel Carmona emailed and said, I listened to the latest episode yesterday and have some comics that I feel are underread. My list in no particular order. The Creech by Greg Capullo. Never heard of it. But that's what this episode was for.
Exactly. Recommending stuff that makes people go, huh?
Thor, The Mighty Avenger by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. The Journey into Mystery run that featured Lady Sif.
Ooh.
And the entire Lone Ranger run from Dynamite. If Emily wants to read a great Western comic, tell her to read the latest Lone Ranger series from Dynamite. Good stuff. As always, great episode. I have not read The Lone Ranger, but I have heard good things about it.
I am intrigued. Now, I would never call myself really a Lone Ranger fan. I'm sort of aware of it. Occasionally, the TV show would be on at my grandparents' house. That movie was atrocious. I will definitely give it its fair shake.
This falls into the kids these days category.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be a generational divide between us regarding our appreciation of The Lone Ranger.
Mm.
That's what I meant to say. It sounds more fancy that way.
Okay, I see. And cementing his place as the new Luke Giaconetti, Noel Thingvall has yet another comment on yet another episode. This time, the post that we made regarding the Mr. Hero bound volume. That Mr. Hero binding is a thing of absolute beauty. Smiley face. Yes. Yes, it is.
I think, as I said in that episode, one of the things I was hesitant about was not getting a good feel of what the finished product would look like. And there were some pictures that I saw. It was still a bit of a leap of faith, and I hope those pictures that we put up were able to give the idea of really what the finished product ended up looking like.
Right. And if anyone else would be interested in doing that with some of their runs, you know, of course I recommend slightly less valuable runs, maybe series or collections that you like but aren't really part of a collection per se for our collector's mentality listeners. But it is absolutely worth it just to be able to set out a beautiful bound volume on your coffee table. That's what I'm doing with that Mr. Hero. That's going on my coffee table. Yeah.
If you have reading copies of your books that are still in pretty good condition, but you're not keeping them for the collected monetary value, then it's a good way to display them, as you said, and to have them easily readable on the bookshelf instead of in miscellaneous long box 13 somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Or lent to a friend, which is what I intend to do with Mr. Hero sometime this week, possibly.
Oh, very good.
On to superhero pros. Be prepared for loads and loads of suggested reading.
Our first email on that topic is from Neil Stanifer, also known as Grammar Merchant. Professor Allen and Emily, I really enjoyed the most recent Short Box Showcase. Not only did I enjoy your examination of superheroes in prose fiction, but I also picked up some great tips for new reading. Mike Grell wrote a Sable novel? Holy schmolies, I'm yoinking that. Now again, Neil, I haven't read it yet, but I will report fully back when I've done so. But I can only imagine that it's awesome. Also, I share your love of Grossman's Soon I Will Be Invincible. By the way, this is not the last time in this episode that praise will be heaped upon that book in feedback.
I am shocked.
I ended up buying a second copy of that one because my first didn't survive being handed around to everyone I knew who couldn't outrun me. Now, one of us recently brought a copy of that book home from her work at the library.
Yes, so while you're reading John Sable, I will be reading Soon I Will Be Invincible.
Neil then schools us on wild cards with a minor correction. I hope you do find the time to read these books. Some of the characters are at least as interesting as almost anything appearing in comics. The characters gain their weird mutations not exactly through the cards. The cards simply serve as a handy index for the mutations. Aces are the true paragons, the superheroes as we normally imagine them. Deuces are folks who got mutations, but their mutations aren't really powers in any true sense. And then there are the unfortunate jokers. I do think you would both enjoy these books, at least the first few. Now, on to my recommendations. Check into Wearing the Cape and its sequel by Marion G. Harmon. If you enjoyed Grossman's book, I think you'll find Harmon's work equally enjoyable. The main character is a young woman, and in the opinion of this adult male reader, the adult male author, Harmon, does a good job of making his young adult female character believable. I've read everything Harmon has put out in this line, and I'm anxiously awaiting the next release.
That sounds epic.
Now, that was one that in doing my, research and searches, that is, Googling things, that this was an author and a series that came up many times in terms of lists of best superhero fiction.
And judging solely by the title, I assume it's going to be sort of along the idea of a slice of lifey sort of thing, of what it's like being a superhero in the sort of practical, emotional senses of what it does to you and your relationships and the dangers that you put yourself in and your ideas of self-identity, which are always the things that I think are the most interesting.
A second recommendation from Neil is the short story Sunlight Society by Margaret Ronald. He reports that he encountered it as an audio piece on the Clark's World podcast. Now, we talked about Escape Pod podcast as a place for sci-fi short fiction in general with the occasional superhero story, and probably Clark's World podcast would be another example of that. The world of Sunlight Society has its own internally consistent logic as it pertains to superhuman, something we don't often find in superhero stories. I wish there were a sequel, but so far, no dice. That's all I have for now. Thanks for all you do. Well, thank you for the feedback, Neil, and the recommendations. By the way, Neil is an English professor, so I would take his literary recommendations seriously.
Duly noted. Zeb Oswalt had a few things to say. Cool podcast as always. I read some of those books years ago. Playing for Keeps was pretty good. I know Mer Lafferty also did voice work on her fellow podcaster's Dwarf Detective book podcast.
Yeah, there's sort of a community of the podcast novelists, and a lot of them appear as voices in each other's book, so that's not too surprising.
He adds that he was glad that fan fiction was mentioned, and talked about a couple that he wrote himself, including some in the Legion. He then questioned whether John Sable counts as a superhero.
What?
He's more of a Spencer for hire guy. That's fair. Still, Grell is an awesome writer, so at some point I might have to read that book. He adds that he used to watch the TV show as a teen, and then closes with, glad Tom Deja's book about the Shadow Legion got mentioned too. Can't wait to hear the next podcast.
I did want to give a shout out also to Thomas DJ, who stepped away from podcasting for a little while for myriad personal reasons. But even during that time, he did reach out to us to thank us for mentioning the Shadow Legion book, and he even sent me an outline of book two.
What? You're keeping that under your hat.
I believe I am empowered to mention a few brief things about that upcoming second book, Steampunk Space Pirates and a Talking Cat.
So he wrote this book for me. Me personally.
I believe so.
Oh, I'm so ready. So ready.
Scott Rifen finally took the advice from his Dinner for Geeks co-host Ron Sadowski and started listening to our shows. Actually, he claims to have been listening for a long time, but either way, he sent his first feedback. And how else are we to know?
It's true.
And as a heavy book reader, it's not surprising that this was the topic that got Mr. Rifen to write in. Professor Allen and Emily, I listened this morning to your superhero prose edition of Shortbox Showcase, and I'm left wondering when I can expect parts 2 through 50 on this topic. This was just to whet the appetite, right?
Well, you can consider this parts 2 through 50, since we're basically just giving you recommendations from everybody else.
I like that. Yeah, we did recognize somewhere during the preparation for that episode that there are way more novels in this genre than we one episode could contain. Yeah. So I guess you never know.
Yeah, firstly, there were a bunch of novels that we'd just never heard of and found through the Googles. Then as soon as we mentioned this, even before we recorded the episode, people were coming out on Facebook and Twitter to give us recommendations. Our final recommendation list was probably something in the range of 45 books to talk about, to mention in that episode. And we decided to whittle that down to like 15 so that we wouldn't be sitting there for 12 hours.
Just with a list.
Yeah.
The checklist of potential superhero novels. Scott points out that Marvel did a series of novels in the 70s that utilized a lot of their then-current writing staff, which gave them a real authentic air to the comic books of the time. They were also short novels with punchy prose. Leave it to superheroes to be punchy.
Ba-dum-tish.
Like you, I enjoyed Soon I Will Be Invincible a lot, but I did find it to be a descendant, albeit a much more enjoyable one, of the novel Super Folks by Robert Meyer.
Huh.
Oh, I could go on and on, but I'd rather hear you two do it. Hopefully, you'll return to this topic, and soon. It's a rich vein with hours and hours and hours of material to mine. Love the shows. Well, thanks, Scott. It's great to have you listening, and we appreciate the feedback. And spoilers, this is not the last time in this episode that we'll mention Scott Rifen. So now he has to keep listening.
Ah, I see what the scheme here is. We mentioned Andy Leyland a few minutes ago and his epic Hey Kids Comics podcast. He wrote us a message with the subject line, books without pictures? It'll never catch on.
It's a fad.
Just a quickie to point you to some other pretty good superhero novels that you may have missed. Nice choice in Soon I Will Be Invincible. It was such a fun book. He also mentions Peter David's novelizations of the 3 Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, and recommends novelizations for Batman Begins and Man of Steel. I have sworn to never watch the film version of Man of Steel, but I think that this is an acceptable loophole.
So maybe the novelization is the way to go.
I think so. It's Superman by Tim DeHaven is worth checking out for its period setting, especially if you like enemies and allies. But it's Batman that seems to lend himself to the books better than the others, though. Andrew Vox wrote a pretty grim novel called The Ultimate Evil, all about child trafficking, which, despite the strong subject matter, lent itself to a Batman story quite well.
I don't have documentation of this. I started keeping track of the books I read maybe 6 or 7 years ago on various websites. But I am pretty sure I've read that one. Or else I've read a pretty similar themed Batman novel, and I'm guessing they didn't do a lot around that theme.
Was it pretty good, as far as you remember, from 10 years ago?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Likewise, Greg Rucka's novel for No Man's Land is fantastic. But given that I think this is one of the best examples of a comics crossover ever, it may be no surprise that the novel is also great. Speaking of adaptations of comics, Roger Stern's Death and Life of Superman and Denny O'Neil's Nightfall are well worth your time as well.
Now, I did not mention this at the time of that recording, but Mike Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor's terrific coverage of that era of Superman on From Crisis to Crisis, and their comprehensive coverage of the death and return of Superman, included regular review segments of that book as they were covering issues.
As
they were covering issues in that long storyline, they would talk about the chapter or two that related to it in the novel. They also talked about the young adult version of that novel that also was published.
That is comprehensive. Back to Andy's email. Upcoming, I'm intrigued by the idea of J.M. DeMatteis adapting Kraven's Last Hunt. And I understand Wayne of Gotham is good, but I've never read it.
I've not heard much about the novel Wayne of Gotham, but the graphic audio version of it is supposed to be very good.
I'm going to have a lot of listening to do when we're done with this. Like, all of graphic audio.
And then we also got a novel from the previously mentioned Michael Bailey. Oops, I mean, we got an email about novels from Michael Bailey of Views from the Long Box, Comics Monthly Monday, and former guest on Short Box Showcase, and guy with a great sense of humor, I hope.
Yes.
Hello, Middletons. I thoroughly enjoyed the most recent episode of Short Box Showcase. While I am predominantly a comic book reader, I still enjoy those stories without pictures.
Blasphemy!
Especially the ones with superheroes in them. You touched on a number of subjects, so the bullet points I have here go in no particular order. Fan fiction. I have no real issue with fan fiction. I don't even have a huge problem with Slash. It's just not in my wheelhouse, but who am I to judge? I actually wrote fan fiction, not Slash, for a few months on a site dedicated to Marvel books. It was a lot of fun, and I don't think it sucked all that bad.
I think even if people don't admit it, most people have written fanfic. It's just buried somewhere in their tweenage journals, but everyone's done it.
Or have certainly worked out those beats in their head.
Yes. Played it out in a role-playing game, something.
Superhero prose. Fun fact. I once had an entire series of novels in my head about a superhero I created. I know, right? What are the odds of that? 100%, evidently.
Just about.
No one has ever done that before, so I figured I'd step up to the plate. Well, that's kind of a lie. Lots of people have done it. I did create my own character when I was about 12, and he evolved a number of times over the years. I even wrote 2 novels based on his adventures in my late teens and early 20s, but never went beyond that. I still have that stuff in my files, but I have no real desire to look at it because my skills as a writer were not the best at that time.
There's a reason they're called trunk novels, Michael. Because they belong in the trunk, never to see the light of day.
See, I'm thinking podcast fiction, podio books.
Become the next E.L. James.
I mean,
bad idea.
I'm suggesting Mike, use some sort of creative nom de plume, Bailey Michaels. I mean, just something that we could never trace back to him.
Genius!
He continues. All of that is to say, I have thought the superhero as a genre of prose has enormous possibilities. Maybe I should give it another shot. What's the worst that could happen?
E.L. James.
So the worst that could happen is a multi-million-dollar movie made out of your book. Gotcha. Snob.
It's a terrible book.
short stories. Y'all mentioned the Further Adventures series that came out around the time of the first two Batman films, and I couldn't help but smile. I bought the first Batman volume shortly before going on a road trip to my grandparents in 1989. While I still wasn't the most persistent of prose readers, I devoured those short stories and enjoyed that anthology quite a bit. I found the Joker volume later in the summer and loved that book as well. That's the two that I had. The first Batman and the Joker version, and they were terrific. It had a number of disturbing stories, but the best was On a Beautiful Summer's Day He Was, which told the story of the Joker when he was a young boy. If either of you haven't read this yet, I say get to it, because it is great, or as great as a story about how a young boy turns a dark corner in his life can be. Like I said, I owned both of those at some point, and when we were preparing for that episode, I took a perusal of our bookshelves, and I could only find the Batman one, so Joker was probably donated to some library somewhere along the way, because I don't have that one anymore.
Well, the local library system appreciates your sacrifice.
Mike continues, Peter David. Despite reading those Batman and Joker stories, it was Peter David that really showed me how awesome superhero prose could be. In the fall of 1995, I was having a pretty rough time. That fall was pretty much my bottom, and I spent most of my time hiding in my comics. I also found two prose books, Ultimate Spider-Man and What Savage Beast. Ultimate Spider-Man was a short story collection that contained stories about, well, Spider-Man. I mean, it's right there in the title. The opening story, which was almost a novella, it was so long, was a retelling of Spider-Man's origin by Peter David. It was, wait for it, amazing!
I see what you did there.
Around the same time, I found What Savage Beast, an Incredible Hulk novel also by Peter David. This book grabbed me and would not let go. I had not become the fan of David's Hulk that I am today, and frankly, this book was what eventually pulled me into reading his run on those comics. Despite not knowing any of what had been going on in the Hulk books, he eased me into it. It was an incredibly, pun intended, emotional story that still gets me to this day. And Michael continues. Wild Cards. Fun fact about the Wild Cards novels. Apparently that whole enterprise came about because George R.R. Martin and his writing friends discovered a superhero role-playing game and became obsessed with it. They played it so much that they weren't getting other work done, so they started writing stories about the characters they created. I am eagerly waiting for HBO to pick up this property as well.
And that just goes to show you that George R.R. Martin is a god, because he can break the cardinal rule of fantasy writing, do not write your role-playing games.
Well, that's probably enough of that. I've gone on long enough. Love the show as always, and take care. Thanks, Mike.
Well, now that we are a third of the way through the episode, let's start the episode. After a few promos.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel. And Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hi, this is Kevin Batchelder. And this is the Saturday B-Movie Reel.
Do something! Shoot it! Shoot it!
That about describes it, yeah.
All right, everybody stay here.
We look specifically at the Sci-Fi Channel's original movies. You know the ones. The ones that air on Saturday night.
Be known throughout the ages as an instant classic.
We need a bigger gator!
Limb cutting, yes. And blood squirting from...
Flying limbs, I called it in my notes.
What could go wrong?
We look on a regular basis at the movies as they come out, and since there have been over 200 of them, we do go back and look at many of them that are now out on DVD. By this point, I had completely forgotten any semblance of seeing if this actually makes any sense from a plot point of view. So come on by, get involved, and have some fun.
Check us out at SaturdayBMovieReel.com.
Our future depends on it. Make it safe.
And we're back to talk about the issue of canon as it relates to fandom.
And we've talked about this a little bit before. It's sort of related to the ideas of continuity and retcons. Real stories, imaginary stories, what really counts. But we wanted to just delve into this particular issue. Mostly inspired by two events that happened 3 and 6 months ago, approximately.
And sort of in essence, these two events took their particular canon in opposite directions.
Yep.
So we have sort of counter examples of what can happen. Now, one is... the Night of the Doctor event.
Yes, which, part of the epic 50th anniversary Doctor Who mega epic
extravaganza
from November of 2013.
And it relates to the actor Paul McGann, who portrayed the Doctor officially for about 90 minutes.
Yes.
In a TV movie that many people... Did not like, and was sort of meant to be a backdoor pilot to an American version, which never went
anywhere.
And it is, to some extent, that movie is the redheaded stepchild of the Doctor Who universe.
Mm-hmm.
But over that sort of dark period for Doctor Who, between that movie and the reboot, Paul McGann... really became a fan favorite.
Yes.
And it took him a few years to sort of not consider that a failure and to recognize how much fans really appreciated his performance.
Mm-hmm.
He also came back a few years later and did many, many,
many,
many hours of audio performances,
mm-hmm,
as the Doctor.
He either has passed or is second to Tom Baker in hours portraying the Doctor, if you include all of his audio dramas and run it up against the length of Tom Baker's 11 seasons or whatever
it was,
portraying the Fourth Doctor. And everybody, well, many people consider him at least one of their top Doctors, if not their favorite, despite the fact the only official version he'd been in was really poorly received.
And so this 8-minute BBC webisode came out really out of nowhere, I think it is safe to say, and burst onto the web, The Night of the Doctor. And what that little piece of video did was it brought all of those prior audio adventures into canon.
Yes.
He references specific people who only existed in the audios, etc.
Yes. Name drops specific people, makes references to having met various characters. It made all of that time dedicated to that Doctor mean something for fans. And the internet broke in half.
It made all of those adventures that he had unofficially as the Doctor, official Doctor adventures as per the BBC. And so, huge fans of Doctor Who.
Shag.
The irredeemable Shag.
Right, sorry.
And Stephen Lacey and others, they were just blown away by this event when it happened.
Their Facebook pages were incoherent for hours. I don't think they were even as excited after the 50th anniversary episode, which was very good. But what actually mattered to them was those 8 minutes of film released on the internet.
And we're using those two, you know, as just as people we know, but really as examples of,
as archetypes,
as
of
segments
fans
of Doctor Who fandom that were just overjoyed by this bringing into canon of these previously unofficial adventures that they had really loved.
And now for something significantly less positive.
The exact opposite things happened to our friends who love Star Wars and the Star Wars extended universe.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of the upcoming seventh movie put out by Disney and J.J. Abrams, they felt they needed to clear the decks and not be hampered by the scores and scores and scores and hundreds of Star Wars novels.
And comics and games and everything.
That have been written since the end of Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
They needed a clean slate and did a clean sweep of all of that material and, in essence, removed it from canon and said, all those books, all those stories, they don't exist anymore.
And once again, the internet broke in half.
I don't know that we'll be able to find the specific link and put it up, but Scott Rifen, who we mentioned before, I believe owned every one of those novels. He certainly owned a huge swath of Star Wars novels. And his reaction, his video that he did regarding that, and sort of talking about the heartbreak of these stories just not meaning anything, is really compelling. And I confess that if we talked about this a year ago, I would have taken a more blasé attitude, because that is sort of the attitude. I'm sort of a laissez-faire person in regards to this.
Yeah, you don't consider yourself a hardcore fan of very many things.
Right.
And after the news about the Star Wars EU being removed from canon, there was the outcry, then there was the outcry against the outcry.
Right.
Saying, it's okay, just calm down. Guess what? Your novels are still there. You can go read them whenever you want. Nothing has been changed.
Don't say that to Scott Rifen.
That's exactly it. Again, when that first happened, I sort of thought, well, yeah, they're right. Your novels are still there. But then I thought about Doctor Who and thought, oh, what if Night of the Doctor, instead of calling out to Charlie, the Doctor had specifically mentioned that he had not had any adventures since the movie and had officially stated that none of those things happened.
Right.
I don't even consider myself a fan of those stories, but I know they're so good and it makes the lore of the show so much better for existing. I would have been crushed. Like, I don't even want to think about what would have happened to Shag or Lacey.
Right, right.
They would have just been inconsolable. And so,
yeah, so I think in that sense, sort of my eyes were opened just to how deep these issues run in fandom. And when you invest that heavily, you get great benefits from that, and there are potential pitfalls that come from being that invested in a fandom. And one of the risks is pulling the rug out from under you.
Mm-hmm. And so I think the issue of this issue is not so much, does canon matter? Because just from these examples of these reactions,
I see that it does.
It absolutely matters. The bigger question is why?
Okay.
So.
Now, you always like to define your terms.
Yes, I do.
So let's talk a little bit about what exactly we mean by canon and some aspects of that.
Well, the word canon is actually Greek for rule or measure, as in a ruler, a meter stick, the thing that all things are measured to. Whenever I think of canon, I think of the canonical texts of the Bible, as opposed to the Apocrypha. That the biblical canon is the list of books that are considered to be accurate and authoritative religious texts. And those are the two words that sort of stick out to me. The works that are considered to genuinely describe whatever the topic is, and the things that everyone agrees matter.
Right, so the words I came up with were authoritative and genuine, and that's pretty much...
Mm-hmm. The real deal, exactly. As it were.
One of the early places, just in a little bit of research, that I found the word canon being used in a sense of a body of literature was in the early 20th century, describing the Arthur Conan Doyle works of Sherlock Holmes as canonical, because even early on, during Doyle's life and probably during his active career of writing Holmes, there were stage play versions and new material coming out, and it's not that far after the closing of the literary canon that movies featuring Sherlock Holmes came into being, some using the Doyle texts as the launching point for an adaptation, but some just coming up with new stories.
This is when you start seeing the word based on.
Right, exactly. So the canonical texts of Sherlock Holmes are the ones written by Arthur Conan Doyle, which, if you take the totality of works featuring Sherlock Holmes in word count or number, minutes of length or whatever, it's a tiny fraction.
Mm-hmm.
But it serves as the fundamental understanding that any version of Sherlock Holmes, whether it's Elementary or whether it's Sherlock or whether it's the Jeremy Brett version of the 80s or Robert Downey Jr.'s version of the movies, they're all measured against that basic original text.
That ruler.
Against that ruler. So we have the official texts that qualify as canon, but that's a little trickier in our world of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have multiple writers, multiple editors, multiple eras. We talked way back in episode 1 about the ages of comics, and we have a golden age Batman or Superman or Captain America is different from a silver age, different from a bronze age, from the modern age.
Right.
And so how do we as fans sort of keep track of what counts both in comic books and in examples like Star Wars and Doctor Who, where there are all of these versions and stories out there from fan fiction, from other authors? How do we keep it straight, or what are some of the other topics that come up in that?
Indeed. Well, if you spend any time on Tumblr, which I must admit, I do.
Oh, you're a 20-something. Right.
Yeah, gotcha. I'm a 20-something that likes nerdy things and hearing the sound of my own voice. I'm on Tumblr, like, all the time. It means there are some other words that are used commonly in fandom discussions. Things like headcanon and fancanon, which make the distinction of not being the official, authorial, authoritative text, but are in some sense derived from it. I personally think that these are interesting, especially as it relates to comic books, because a lot of people's ideas of my Superman, my Batman, or, as with Paul Levitz, my Legion.
Right, exactly.
Is in lot derived from headcanon. The things that you personally think are accurate and true to the character. Because there have been so many versions and authors' takes and eras and all of this stuff.
I think sort of what we're getting at here is what is indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
To making that character that character.
Exactly.
And what can be jettisoned.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of Elseworld stories featuring Superman. Almost all of them start with him being rocketed off of an exploding planet Krypton to somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
To the United States, to the Soviet Union, to the fifth dimension Mr. Mixius Piddalick's world.
Oh.
That happened.
That sounds both fascinating and awful.
There was another one where it wasn't just Superman, it was 10,000 Kryptonians to colonize a planet or to take over. But if you don't have rocketed from an exploding planet Krypton, do you have Superman?
Indeed.
Do you have Batman if the Wayne parents live? What are the indispensable portions of a character? And it isn't necessarily the origin. Those are just the mm-hmm. examples I came up with.
Right.
The basic power set, the basic look. is having red briefs outside the tights an indispensable portion of Superman. To some fans who are disheartened by the New 52, that answer is yes. A red belt does not make him Superman.
Indeed.
And so we all have those versions.
Yes. And that's the important thing about headcanon, is that your personal headcanon is different from almost everybody else's.
And sometimes, because it's so ingrained in us, we have a hard time seeing how someone else might have a different headcanon.
And this is one of the things that you have to think about with fans becoming writers. In a lot of cases, right. It's great because fans have a better sense of the characters than a writer who was just pulled and read the Wikipedia page and is doing it for pay, has never read a Superman comic in their life.
That's fair.
But it also means that those fans will have biases about what Superman should or shouldn't be. Should he kill? Should he wear the red briefs? Should he be kind of a jerk? Those are all things that are independent to a specific writer and their personal understanding of the character. And sometimes it's better for the good of the story to try and keep those personal opinions out of it. Which is why some people love Paul Levitz, because their headcanons line up with his. People whose canons do not line up with his don't always like his version, because they would prefer a slightly different version, and he does not choose to write that version.
What Emily's referencing is that one of the things that makes reading the Legion somewhat difficult, bordering on incomprehensible.
Yes.
This is that Paul Levitz wrote a large chunk of it, but not continuously. He keeps coming back every few years, and when he does, he yanks it back his direction.
Mm-hmm.
And other writers, whether it's Mark Waid or whoever, you know, pulls it in a different direction. And so it is, there are disjointed, discontinuous aspects of the continuity.
And that's the thing, is I like Paul Levitz. He's a very good writer who writes an interesting Legion. I love Legion. I love all kinds of Legion. But I think that his insistence on using his headcanon and his version of the Legion, despite the turns and twists and developments the book is making when he comes back to it, hurts the series.
And we mentioned that the word canon has this, you know, biblical root to it. It also goes the other way as well, where sometimes an editor for a character, or the showrunner of a TV show, when they write up the basics of a character, the basics of the plot, the type of show or the type of a comic book, who the important characters are, it's called the show Bible.
The story Bible. Yep.
Now, this idea of headcanon is just not, you know, writers, and it's not necessarily serious trying to, you know, make sense of it. It's sort of what versions work for you and how we as fans can make
rationalize
story,
can
rationalize things that don't always make sense. You know, we're always discarding parts of things. Super ventriloquism? No. Boom, that does not exist in my headcanon. Sorry, Superman does not have that power.
Super law? Super rainbow duplicate shooting finger power? He does have super digging.
Super tunneling? One of my favorite books, I'm sure we've mentioned it here, it's actually a series of three books written by Michael Fleischer in the early 1970s, as a result of being brought in by DC Comics to read every comic book that they had written.
Yes.
In Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman specifically. And he produced the Superman Encyclopedia, the Batman Encyclopedia, and the Wonder Woman Encyclopedia. And what I love about those books is that they take a pseudo tongue-in-cheek academic view, where he acknowledges where there's conflicts in the stories, but he'll say something like, some sources claim that Batman knew of Kathy Kane's identity beforehand, but the preponderance of the evidence is otherwise, or something to that effect, where it's attempting to rationalize stories that are not perfectly in continuity. And I think that's something that we all sort of do.
Indeed. That, on the one hand, takes it to the ridiculous extreme of everything is canon and continuity, and
we have to figure out a way to make it
any sense. But, on the other hand, sometimes, and I would say often, headcanons are kind of ridiculous. The one that I like to bring up is, I've mentioned it before on an episode or two, I freaking love the show Leverage.
Hi, Michael Bailey.
Hi, Michael! How are you enjoying season 5? That means that I see Leverage kind of everywhere. And when I started watching the hilariously, wonderfully, and ridiculously kind of camp Remington Steele, I thought of Remington Steele, played by Pierce Brosnan, as a perfect representation of the child of Nate and Sophie from Leverage. And as soon as I realized this, I started looking for evidence. I now have this giant, complex web of things that somehow ties together Doctor Who, James Bond, Remington Steele, the not very good movie After the Sunset, to Leverage. It is ridiculous. It is of Tumblr proportions of nonsense. One of these days, I'm going to draft it up and stick it on there and see if I can get anybody else to agree with it. But that is my personal headcanon, that Pierce Brosnan is playing one character throughout all of these clearly unconnected pieces of media.
A similar one that ties into some things we've mentioned is the idea that James Bond is, in fact, a Time Lord.
Exactly.
Which explains why every few years he changes faces, changes personality somewhat, but is fulfilling the same basic purpose.
Indeed.
A similar one on my end is, I've mentioned my fandom of Mike Grell. And as much as I love Mike Grell's storytelling and his artistic skill, he has a couple of faces that he likes to draw over and over again. And so my headcanon is that Travis Morgan Warlord and only Mike Grell's version of Oliver Queen are actually twins separated at birth, which explains why they look so much alike and they have a distant relative, Starslayer. But that's another story.
Yes.
And Shakira in Warlord and the woman in Starslayer are evidently twins as well because they wear the same fur bikini. This connection of Grell was then further strengthened by a particular issue of Warlord that I read where his contact in the U.S. military was clearly John Sable. I mean, he did not even try to hide the identical nature of those two men.
Change the hair color, throw a beard on him? Nope.
It was the exact John Sable representation. So that's my version of headcanon, how all of those Mike Grell characters connect. So that's silly. Where does headcanon tie into fan theory? My idea is that fan theory is a little more serious version of this almost, or at least more people involved trying to make sense. Sort of where do those tie in?
Fan theory is what happens when you can get enough people to at least acknowledge your headcanon. To just think, oh, maybe that is a possibility.
So not the silly, absurd ones we just spun, but somewhat
well,
more...
Well, if I can get 3,000 retweets on Twitter and 3,000 upvotes on Reddit or whatever, then I might be able to make a case for fan theory. The key about fan theory is it has to be something that's sort of generally acknowledged.
At least by a portion of fandom.
Exactly. By a portion. Not a majority, but a large enough,
or at least an identifiable portion of fandom.
Exactly. Sometimes, if enough people can agree on a fan theory, it can become fan canon, which is a more fixed version of these things. It's sort of slowly evolving from your own crazy idea to 500 people having a crazy idea to a pretty large number of people accepting that that might actually be a subtext or something going on in the background.
Or being quote-unquote true.
Yes.
Even within the context of the story.
Even though it's not explicitly stated, right, or may even have very flimsy evidence.
Now, I've seen some of these in regards to the Pixar movies. Is that sort of what you're getting at? Sort of those connections, theoretically, sort of, maybe?
Well, we will take the movie Frozen, which, once again, people on Tumblr adore. The fact that Tangled and Frozen, the two Disney CG animated films, take place in the same universe is pretty much canon. There's a cameo from Rapunzel and Eugene in the first 5 or 10 minutes of the movie Frozen. So the two of them take place in the same universe, accepted. Then there are theories, and I would say even a fan canon, that Rapunzel and the sisters from Frozen, Anna and Elsa, are actually cousins. There is some evidence about this, and the mother of Rapunzel and the father of the sisters, and it does make sense.
There is a way that it could be true.
Indeed, and there's no evidence against it. It's at the very least plausible, but there's been no evidence that this is in fact true, but a vast, vast amount of the fans of both of those films consider it to be true.
And they want it to be true.
Yes.
And if they can't get behind this, you know what they need to do? Just let it go.
Thank you. And then you can go for total crazy sauce. The idea that all of the Pixar movies take place in the same universe. There have been 15 apocalypses over the course of 10,000 years. That there was like a rise of the machines, and that's how we get cars. And at the same time, bugs were the only living material to survive. And it is insane.
Are you discounting the talking fish period of our
human existence? Evolution? Yeah. To the best of my knowledge, even crazy hardcore fans do not actually believe that this is true. So that sort of shows the different tiers that these ideas can have. Things that are just funny to think about, things that are plausible, things that have some evidence and the fans in general decide want to be true, and then the canon, the actual things that exist in the text.
So I think that through technology, fandoms have really had opportunities to come together. I mean, these discussions, debates, conversations would have taken place in a letters page or in a fanzine between 3 or 4 people and their 200 mimeographed, mailed out subscription list. But now it can be thousands and thousands of people on Facebook and Tumblr, etc., with these theories. One that interests me in terms of fan theories is in George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire series. Because those books, A, are really long and detailed, B, many years takes place between their publication, so fans have plenty of time to talk about them, dissect them, and figure out...
scrutinize every single sentence of every single description of every single food item.
There is that, and then also the people, because George makes a big deal about people's hair color, skin tone, eye color, shapes of the eyes, height, weight, those sorts of things, and people perhaps reading into that, or perhaps reading out of it, implications of who's actually related to who, and these people who are 20 years apart look strikingly alike. They actually might be father and son, even though they're in different tribes now. And so you have fan theories about the end result of those series of novels is who ends up being king.
Mm-hmm.
Or queen.
Not a queen. A Khaleesi.
Who ends up... Well, that's one of the issues. One of the issues is Dany really the last Targaryen? Because based on the way that certain other people are described, up at the wall or in different areas, different parts of Westeros, there might be a secret Targaryen.
Or two.
So one of the fan theories is that there is this other sort of dark horse candidate for the throne, or who is whose illegitimate son or daughter, and therefore has a more clear line of ascension to the throne. Martin recently came out and said he has read in some fan forums the right answer, the answer that he is currently planning. He hasn't said what it is, and he hasn't said whether that's going to cause him to change it or cause him to read, write any differently. But I think we're in sort of a new era here in the last decade or two where fans can really have an impact. I mean, the impact that fans had 100 years ago were begging.
Pleading.
Were begging and pleading with Arthur Conan Doyle to not have actually killed Sherlock Holmes at the end of the, the Reichenbach Falls story. Doyle attempted to kill Holmes more than once, as a matter of fact, and fan demand that he bring that character back. But that was the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
But now, more very particular plot issues are discussed in such detail by fans that, for good or ill, they can have an effect on creators, I think. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's a net positive, a net negative, but I do think it's a thing.
Yes. And we'll get to that in particular in just a few minutes. Mm-hmm. But from what I've been aware of, Martin does not appear to have any intention of changing
the ending. I think that's the case, right.
He might make a few slight allowances to try and conceal the truth a little
bit. One more red herring, one more diversion, maybe.
Mm-hmm. One more possible candidate, one more presumed death.
Right.
Something like that, just to throw people off the scent a little bit. But it as far as I'm aware, it's not going to have any impact on the plot. Bringing this back to comics, because we've been talking for about 20 minutes about not comic books.
What? How did that happen?
On a comic book show.
No.
Let's bring this back to the first...
The first significant
time that this was an actual, really big issue. Armageddon 2001 was a crossover or event series that included one of the heroes in the cast going insane and becoming a supervillain.
And the big mystery of the story was, who is this?
Indeed. The entire framing story was centered around trying to figure out this mystery and finding out what had happened. Turns out that in between issues, the fans figured it out.
I mean, there were clues. They were, be fair to DC, they were playing fair. To be fair to the writer, they had seeded clues. They had done all the right narrative and writing techniques.
Indeed. Everyone had just figured it out faster. Partially, I would think, from the rise of really well-circulated fanzines and
the birth of the very early internet bulletin boards,
Usenets, things like that, that you could at the very least circulate your newsletter through email.
Right.
It could get out to more people. You could get responses. That just with that early bit of technology uniting fans, they were able to figure out the answer about 6 months earlier than they were supposed to, which led DC to a conundrum. They know the ending. What do we do? They decided that they would change it to a character that it made no sense to be, a character that they had already ruled out through their own storytelling. This means that a lot of people, fans and just critics of literature, really hate this story.
If you read the story without knowledge of the controversy and what happened, it doesn't make sense.
Indeed.
It can't be the way they're telling it.
And furthermore, the fans were mad at them for ruining a character. Taking one of the characters that had been shown to be a paragon of good throughout the entire series and suddenly turning him evil in order to have a shocking twist. This, I would say, is the counterpoint to Martin's, do not do this. And again, it was early. They had this new technology. There was communication between fans. How do we handle this? Secret getting out. And they didn't know what they were doing, so they made...
It was the first time you faced
worst,
with that.
Exactly. Yeah. They made kind of the worst choice they could have made, but they didn't have any experience to tell them it would be a bad idea.
Right.
We now know better, and a lot of creators are better about this.
Although some creators will then throw raw meat to Tumblr, etc. Usually as throwaway lines or as gags. Sherlock is sort of classic
infamous
for that. But others as well will again, almost
baiting.
Baiting or, the castle.
mm-hmm.
with his annual Halloween costume is usually some either dig at fans or a nod to fans in some way. So the wall between creators and fans is coming down.
Yes.
And so there's much more interaction, both the Lost creators and Ron Moore of Battlestar Galactica in the reimagined version. For the last few years of that show, of Battlestar, he would release a podcast commentary for the episode the day that the episode was going to air on Sci-Fi. So you could actually have the showrunners, executive producers' commentary as you were watching the first run of the show. And Lost was one of the first TV shows to really take advantage of social media with official Lost podcasts featuring mm-hmm. the writers and featuring the creators. And so it really had that interactive yes. aspect.
And as you said, this can be good and bad. And creators can view it as good
right.
and bad. The way that they relate to their fans, keeping track of all of the minutiae of the show for them can be a hindrance or a huge boon.
And I've heard some creators refer to their fan bases, usually positively, as their wiki.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes negative, because they'll point out, you know, inconsistencies and that. But they, you know, but some creators have become much more welcoming mm-hmm. of that relationship.
Whenever I think about these sorts of issues about canon and fans influencing the shows and fan theories predicting the endings of the story before the creator can get to them, I always think of Howard Taylor, the creator of Schlock Mercenary, the webcomic. It's a webcomic. Of course he's internet savvy. It was one of the first big web... almost one of the first webcomics, period. It's been going on forever. Because of that, the mythos of the comic right. is enormous. It's an interstellar space opera. There's something like 950 named characters. It's insane.
The problem is it's written three panels at a time, and you can't go back and edit them
nope.
once they're out.
Once it's done, it's done. It is canon. You can't retcon. It's there in the archives forever, and you've got to deal with it.
You can't go back in the graphic novel and change what someone has said, which Marvel and DC have done in the past.
Yep.
Literally change dialogue when they reprint a story. Not just, you know, we miscolored the cape, so we're going to fix that,
mm-hmm.
but actually change some of the content.
And what he often talks about when he's talking about his fans is both a boon and a little bit of mm-hmm. a burden, but mostly a boon, because he actually uses them as his canon, as his meter stick, that he'll go and trawl on the boards for the most popular fan theories. And some people will say, well, clearly these five panels were setting up this to be the result. And he'll think to himself, oh, I didn't mean that.
But now
I've got a great red herring.
Ah, right.
Or occasionally will actually change it because he's plotted the story and it's not quite working. And he's 6 months away from the conclusion, you know, 900 panels or something. And he just thinks, it's not quite right. Something just doesn't feel quite right. And someone will mention something and go, hey, has anyone noticed that this character really should be acting more like this? And he'll think, That's it. That's what I missed. Okay, so now I've got 900 panels to change this character to have an arc to end up at that place in order to fix my ending before I get there. So I think that's just insanely cool. It's a way of telling, like, no one's guessed the ending. Clearly I haven't set it up enough. Because if people who are spending 3 hours a day dissecting his story can't pick up the clues he's leaving, he's not leaving enough clues.
That was DC's mistake with Armageddon 2001. That interpretation that if they figured it out, we've done something wrong. If they figured it out, you've done something right.
Indeed.
I mean, there's nothing worse than that mystery where at the last page it says, and did you figure this out, reader? and the answer is so absurd. There's no way you could have figured it out from the what you told me beforehand. The point of a good mystery is to seed the answers. Maybe they should have had more red herrings. Maybe they should have had other options. But I love Taylor's idea of, if people aren't guessing it, I haven't done well enough. And I think that's probably what George R. R. Martin is sort of thinking,
indeed,
too. So, again, I don't think he's scared mm-hmm. by the fact that he's read the solution a few places online.
And some people are. It's, and there are legit concerns about, you know, are fans going to begin controlling shows? You know, even people have talked about, now I'm just going to say this now, I am one of the few people on Tumblr who has not seen every episode of Supernatural, but my understanding is that some point around season 5 or 6, the executives, producers, the writers were getting ready to wrap it up and move on, and the fans didn't want their favorite show to end. And so they kind of had to rush and cobble together new writers and new editors and people to keep the show going. And those 2 or 3 seasons that the fans demanded are their least favorite because the writers that they loved were not associated with it anymore. And it was what they wanted. It's what they asked for, but it's not what they wanted. And that's a big problem, that a lot of times fans don't really know what they actually want.
This is hard for comic book fans to understand with the nature of the ongoing serialization of comic books. But good stories have beginnings, and
middles,
they have middles,
and ends.
And they have ends.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need to bring a story to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of TV, that's changed a little bit in that creators are having a little more control. And it's not just on the HBOs and the AMCs where the creators are pitching a limited run series, and that's being approved.
Mm-hmm. Again, let's go back to Leverage. Something that I love about Leverage is either they said the 5th season will be our final season, or the network told them your 5th season will be your final season. And they structured the entirety of the 5th season to be an ending. That it has a proper close. That there is an arc of everyone getting sort of tired and feeling like they need a change. Or that they're not treading water the same way that they have been. That things are happening. That there are big character reveals or character changes that are going to end the story as we know it. And after delaying for something like 2.5 months, I did finally watch the last episode of Leverage, and it is the perfect capper because they knew it was going to end and they ended it well, which is, those are two things that do not always happen. Sometimes you just are like, well, this is your last episode. Too bad it ends on a cliffhanger. Or you try and cram in all of the fan service or do a really big epic twist that nobody's gonna understand or like. How I Met Your Mother, Lost.
Right.
And that's part of the difficulty, is that then your fans are gonna be mad that it ended because it didn't end well.
A couple classic examples of this. One is a pretty little known sitcom called Sledgehammer, which was basically the Naked Gun, Airplane, Police Squad,
okay,
sort of version, satire of a cop show.
Okay.
Trust me, it was really good.
Okay.
And it ended its season with literally the world exploding.
This That's
was
amazing.
A major terrorist. The last scene is the shot from space of Earth blowing up. Because they knew they were going to be canceled.
That's amazing.
They got another year.
Oh!
So they come back. The first thing they said was, you know, they replayed that, you know, previously on. They said, the following stories take place 2 years before. Because, and then classically, another one was Magnum P.I.
Mm-hmm.
Where Magnum is shot and killed at the end of an episode to end the season. And the show got renewed, and they had to come up with the craziest, beyond comic book way that he actually survived. And it wasn't just if you don't see the body. No, it was... It was, we see the body, we see the organs coming out at the autopsy. Well, not quite, but the equivalent of that. It was dead, dead, dead.
No, that's what they do. But then they go previously on, and they're taking the organs out, and they put a toaster in, and he's a $6 million man.
Exactly. So, you know, so there's this idea of sometimes fans don't always get what they want, and what they want, not,
yeah,
you know.
Not always. What they ask for is not always what they
exactly
really want. What they
exactly
get often is not what they wanted, but sometimes it is for the better.
I'm not saying that I don't like this community
mm-hmm
of fans and creators, but I do like letting creators create.
Indeed.
And letting fans fan in general.
Mm-hmm. And let's go with, you know, we are a podcast. We like new media. Let's talk about one of the three biggest podcasts, Welcome to Night Vale, which has a huge fan base. Like, mm-hmm, it is insane. And again, that fan base has a rich and complex fan canon. A lot of times, the creators will actually look for ideas in the fan canon and make references to things that have been referenced in fan canon. And that's actually, again, a way of expanding the mythos. And that, I think, is where fans in connection with creators really works, is helping the creators make a more fully fleshed out world, or keeping track of their insanely complex world, as with Schlock Mercenary. I think this is pretty great. A lot of creators are kind of scared of it, most infamously. I don't think we can really talk about fan control of creative works without talking about the Stephen King novel and its film adaptation, Misery, in which a crazy fangirl whose pairing was split up because one of the characters dies kidnaps and tortures the writer in order to bring the character back and give the couple the happy ending that she came up with. Obviously a metaphor. There is no subtlety.
You think?
And on the one hand,
you think
I'm like,
the writer being held hostage by a crazy fan is a metaphor? No.
And, well, I certainly understand.
As subtle a writer as Stephen King can
I know,
be.
Right? Now, while I understand Mr. King's fears and discomfiture with fans,
that
they
might be an extreme response.
They are a largely benevolent force.
Right. I think that's true.
And when working with creators, absolutely a positive for the thing that they're both trying to make. Because we've even talked, you know, to throw in one last can of worms at the end of the episode, we've talked about authorial intent. And does a work belong to the fans? Well, does it actually belong to the author? It's one of those things that it's almost like they are the parents. It belongs to both of them.
And I think part of this is reflected in that phrase, and we'll put it on Superman just because I think that's where the passion runs deepest. And
yes,
I think that's where we hear the phrase most often, though I'm sure people say, that's not my Scarlet Witch. But mostly they say, that's not my Superman, or that is my Superman. And when that's shortcut for, that's not my favorite version of character X, I totally understand that. But the idea of fan ownership, and I think it's reflected in that shorthand, that's not my, or that is my. Mentioned Mike Grell, the character of Warlord, for a little while after he had a falling out with DC, was rebooted and written by another writer at some point. I don't collect those. Because it's not that original version. But if someone else likes it and reads it, that's fine with me. It says Warlord. It is Warlord. It's not the version that I like. But it's that shorthand of that's not my that implies an ownership or a control over something.
Mm-hmm.
That's my car. That's my house. That's my bottle of water. But that means I actually have a right to it when we use that phrase.
Yeah. this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. This is not my beautiful Superman.
But I think sometimes that real personalization mm-hmm. of the character or identification with a particular version of a character or a property, it can set you up for heartbreak.
Yes.
To say the least.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to get too much into creator ownership and mm-hmm. these sorts of questions too much, let's tie it back to Paul Levitz. As I said earlier, I think that the team he loves is harmed by his insistence on a specific version. It makes it harder for other people to enjoy it the way that he does. And the goal of fans should be to spread their love of a character mm-hmm. to other fans and to let that love be known to creators. And the role of a creator should be to make good stories featuring the characters that people love, which people can consume. And if your story is making it harder to consume or harder to enjoy, you're not necessarily doing your job. Generalizations, okay. obviously. Okay. But I think the point of a creator and their fan base should mm-hmm. be to work together to make the thing they mutually love as good as it can be. Right. And when either one is impeding that relationship, it's a problem.
Well, like you said, certainly a way to open up a can of worms right as we're closing the episode.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Woohoo! This is what I do.
So you made our listeners get this far in the episode right before sticking it to them.
No. I like to keep our fans on their toes.
I like it. And if the first 20 to 25 minutes of the show aren't strong enough evidence of this, we really like your feedback.
That we do.
And feel free to give us your thoughts on canon, on fandom, the role of fans within canon. How exactly James Bond is a Time Lord and what number doctor he is anyway.
Ah.
Shag, we're leaving that one for you to figure out.
All feedbacks, comments, and crazy fan theories are welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. You can also comment on the individual episode postings at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
Or you can leave us feedback and a rating in iTunes. We'd really appreciate that. That helps more people find the shows.
So this has been a really long episode about a kind of controversial topic and authorial rights and fan entitlement. And next time, let's try for something simple and less divisive. What's the word?
Grease? Grease is the word, is the
Stop.
Word,
is
the
Serendipitous. Word. It has a lot of syllables in it. We mentioned Andy Leyland recently. Not recently, like 5 minutes ago. Hello, Prof and Emily. Just a quickie to point you... Oh gosh, he's British. All of his words are in weird orders. Okay.
You know that's going in the outtakes, right?
I know. Just a quickie to point you to some other pretty good... Oh my... Okay. I'm just going to read this, and then I'll read it.
You got to talk to her with a funny accent. Just a quick point to you to point some of the good superhero novels you may have missed.
Gosh, you actually managed to get through that better than I did. Okay. We love you, Andy. We're just taking the piss out.
Big yawn real quick.
Am I saying this whole first line?
You can... You can just do the and we're back if you want, and then I can jump into the talking about a little bit. However you want to do that. I will follow your lead. Oh, Deep Space Nine. Nice.
That's going to be the promo. There's a new Tutu Freak show.
Because, of course, there
about
is.
Deep Space Nine. And we're back.
Are you going to finish, Bill?
Oh. At the whole... You expect me to say, like, 11 words, not just three? Are red tights on the outside of a suit indispensable for Batman. Well, no, because it's Superman.
Nice catch.
Our red tights outside.
Our red box. Red briefs. Red undies.
I don't be insulting to the man who could burn me with his eyes.
Throw you into the sun.
Throw me into the sun. Thank you, Scott Gardner.
I think Clark has a good sense of humor about the underpants. This was my brainchild. But I'm glad you were here with me, making it better.
I know. I don't want to cut it like short right now.
I think I'm pretty much done. I think I've actually hit basically.
You've hit most of your points.
All of my stuff. Even talking a little bit about Word of God with authorial intent. So, I think I am set.